Usually when we look at a medical monitor, there's a comforting certainty to
Yeah.
it, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's measurable.
Right. A heart rate monitor shows a rhythmic spike, and you just know the heart is beating. Or an oxygen sensor reads 99%, and, well, you know the lungs are working. It's all visible data.
Yeah, but then you walk into a neurology ward.
Exactly. You walk in, and you look at someone lying perfectly still. I mean, their eyes might be open, but they aren't responding to their name. They aren't tracking your movement. And suddenly, all those monitors just feel entirely inadequate.
Because the most important question isn't whether their heart is beating, it's whether anyone is actually home.
Yeah, that's the real question. And that diagnostic void is exactly what we are diving into today. This is a custom deep dive crafted entirely for you, looking at a stack of neuroimaging research and a really thought-provoking summary. It's anchored by Cody Cottier's Scientific American article. Are the roots of consciousness hidden in the ancient deep brain?
It's such a fascinating piece of work.
It really is. So we are going to hunt for where consciousness actually lives in the physical tissue of the brain, how we even begin to define it, and why the ultimate working rule in medicine, and honestly in life, is that when someone cannot tell you what they feel, you should never, ever assume the feeling is gone. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, the central tension we're looking at here is a massive ongoing debate in neuroscience. Does conscious experience start in this sophisticated, folded outer layer of the brain, the
Yeah, the
cortex?
wrinkly part we always see in pictures.
Exactly. Or does it run much deeper down into the ancient evolutionary basement of the subcortex? But I mean, before we can go looking for consciousness in the anatomy, we have to pin down what the word even means.
Which is famously frustrating. I mean, there is literally a psychology dictionary out there that called consciousness impossible to specify and boldly claimed that nothing worth reading had ever been written about it.
Yeah, you can completely understand the frustration,
I
though,
totally.
because you can never directly observe the inner state another person is describing to you. You only have their behavior and, well, what they tell you to go on. But modern research does break it down into three distinct measurable levels.
Right, the three levels.
Yeah. So first, you have wakefulness. That's just the physiological state of being on. The brain stem is sending arousal signals up to the rest of the brain. You're not asleep. You're not in a coma.
Just biologically awake. Then the second level is awareness, right? That's your brain actively registering the world around you, or even your own internal body states.
Like hearing a sound or feeling cold.
Exactly. You hear a door slam, you feel a drop in temperature. But the third level, that's the holy grail, subjective experience and self-awareness.
The really tricky stuff.
Yeah, philosophers call these qualia. It's the private, totally unshareable texture of an experience. It's the specific, undeniable redness of the color red, or like the sharp, all-consuming throb of a toothache.
Which brings in a crucial distinction formalized by the cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker. He separates the easy problem of consciousness from the hard problem.
Okay, break that down for us.
So the easy problem is explaining the mechanical functions. If we want to understand how the brain processes light, we can trace the mechanism, right? Photons hit the retina, they get converted into electrical spikes.
And those spikes travel down the optic nerve.
Right, they get sorted in the thalamus and are routed to the visual cortex where they are assembled into shapes and borders.
So it's essentially an engineering problem. I mean, complex, sure, but solvable. The wiring is all there to be mapped.
Exactly. But the hard problem is explaining why all of that physical, biological processing actually feels like anything at all.
Yeah, why isn't it all just happening in the dark?
Right. William James famously described this as the stream of consciousness, this always moving, never repeating flow of inner life. And the humbling part is that everything we are actively aware of is just the tiny tip of an iceberg.
Because so much is happening underneath.
Oh, the vast majority of the computations your brain performs never even reach that conscious stream.
It makes me think of a smartphone. The three levels map out pretty cleanly if you think about it.
Oh, how so?
Well, wakefulness is just the phone being powered on, right? The battery is supplying voltage to the motherboard.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, and then awareness is opening the camera app. The lens is taking in light. The software is drawing a little yellow box to track a face. It's successfully reacting to its environment.
Right, it's aware of the face.
Exactly.
Well.
But subjective experience, that would be if the phone was actually enjoying the sunset it was recording. I mean, how do you get from a face tracking algorithm to a genuine feeling of awe?
That is the million-dollar question. And if we accept that a smartphone enjoying a sunset is the true mark of consciousness, the immediate problem for a neurologist becomes, well, where is the hardware for enjoyment actually kept?
Where does that subjective feeling physically happen in the brain tissue?
Right. And the traditional textbook view has heavily favored the cortex for decades, that wrinkly outer sheet of the brain you mentioned earlier.
Because we know it handles the complex stuff, right?
Exactly. Language, memory, planning, reflective thought. And for a long time, the studies backed this up largely because vision has dominated the research.
Vision is just easier to test in a lab setting.
It really is. You flash a picture on a screen, you ask the person if they saw it, and you track the brain activity. And when they report seeing the image, the activity concentrates in what researchers call the posterior hot zone in the back of the cortex.
So it all points to the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where we hit that phenomenon called blindsight, right?
Yes. And what's fascinating here is that blindsight introduces a massive complication in the clinical data. There are patients who have suffered severe damage to their visual cortex.
Okay.
If you ask them what they see, they will tell you they are completely blind. They experience total darkness.
Wow.
Yet, if you put an object in front of them and ask them to guess its shape or to reach out and grab it, they can do it with an accuracy well above chance.
Wait, so their brain is processing the visual information, but the actual experience of seeing is totally gone.
Exactly. Because of the mechanism behind how vision is routed, the optic nerve splits. While the vast majority of the signals go to the sophisticated cortex to create the image you consciously see, a smaller pathway goes down into the primal brainstem to handle spatial orientation.
Oh, I see.
So when the cortex is destroyed, that primal pathway still guides the hand, but the lights are off in the mind. This proves something vital, orienting towards something or reacting to it, does not automatically equal an inner experience.
Behavior is not a direct readout of the mind. That's wild.
Right, which shifts the entire paradigm. Researchers like Mark Solms argue that by focusing so heavily on vision, the field started with the wrong sense entirely.
Because vision is outward facing. It's about mapping the external world.
Exactly. Solms argues we should start with feeling, affect. Basic survival needs like hunger, fear, or distress. An animal doesn't need to write a poem about fear. It needs to feel fear so it can rank competing survival needs in real time.
Right, like do I run from the predator or do I stop to eat?
Exactly. And if you trace the neurology of those primal feelings, the trail doesn't lead to the sophisticated cortex. It leads down into the deep brain, specifically the subcortex and the brainstem.
Which brings up the hydranencephaly research, right? The source material highlights work by Bjorn Merker on this.
Yes. It's a rare developmental condition where children are born essentially without a cerebral cortex.
Which is the very part of the brain we usually assume is required for consciousness.
Right. The fluid-filled space leaves only the brainstem and some subcortical structures intact. Yet caregivers repeatedly report that these children show genuine comfort. They show distress, they anticipate things, they engage socially, they even smile when played with.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here. Because we just established with blindsight that a behavior isn't a direct readout of an experience.
That's a very fair point.
So how do we know those kids with hydranencephaly aren't just showing reflexive, unconscious behavior, like a knee-jerk reaction when a doctor taps your patellar tendon?
Right.
If a smile is just a motor reflex generated by the brainstem, how is it proof of an inner life?
That is the exact crux of the debate. And honestly, skepticism is necessary here. Merker's findings don't definitively prove these children have the same complex reflective experience as a typical child.
Right.
However, when caregivers observe persistent, context-appropriate emotional responses, anticipation, distinct social play, targeted distress, dismissing all of that as mere reflex requires us to ignore a massive amount of behavioral evidence.
I guess that makes sense. It's too complex to just be a knee jerk.
Exactly. It forces the scientific community to consider that basic sentience, you know, the raw feeling of simply being alive, might survive even when the higher processing centers are absent.
And if deep ancient brain structures are enough to generate basic feelings, well, then humans aren't the only ones with an inner life. I mean, the biological hardware for basic feeling is much older than humanity.
We share those deep brain structures with a vast portion of the animal kingdom.
Yeah, and the sources bring up the New York Declaration on Animal Consciousness.
Mm.
This is a major turning point in the scientific consensus, right?
Oh, absolutely. It argues for strong scientific support of conscious experience in mammals and birds, and a realistic possibility of it in all vertebrates and even many invertebrates.
Like octopuses and insects. But, you know, for a long time, science looked for human-like markers of self-awareness in animals.
Like the mirror test.
Yes, the mirror test was the gold standard. You put a mark on an animal's face, place them in front of a mirror, and see if they try to wipe it off.
And great apes pass. Dolphins pass.
But dogs reliably fail. But, I mean, that test assumes an animal actually cares about a visual reflection, or that it naturally makes eye contact.
Which a lot of animals view as a direct threat.
Exactly. Judging a dog's consciousness by its ability to use a mirror is like judging human intelligence by our ability to smell a hidden bone under 3 feet of dirt. It's just using the wrong metric completely.
I love that analogy. And modern science is finally catching up to that logic. Researchers like Birch, Schnell, and Clayton are pushing a new framework. They argue we need to completely drop this idea of a single ladder of consciousness with humans sitting at the top and simple organisms at the bottom.
Okay, so if not a ladder, what is it?
Instead, they propose a set of multiple dimensions.
So instead of a ladder, it's more like a character creation screen in a role-playing game. You've got, like, sliders for different traits.
Precisely. You have a slider for perceptual richness. How detailed is their sensory world? A slider for evaluative richness. How deeply do they feel good or bad states?
Oh, interesting.
Sliders for integration over time and self-related processing. Under this model, a bee, an octopus, a dog, and a human just plot differently across these dimensions.
So an octopus might have its sensory richness slider maxed out, allowing it to taste with its tentacles and change color based on environment. But its social self-awareness slider might be turned way down compared to a wolf.
Right. It doesn't mean the octopus lacks a magic ingredient. Its inner life is just shaped by different evolutionary pressures.
Okay, but bringing this back to the human experience, we're dealing with all of these dimensions at near maximum capacity simultaneously.
We really are.
So how does a healthy human brain orchestrate all of this perception, emotion, and self-awareness without just collapsing from sensory overload? Because here's where it gets really interesting.
Well, it survives through a strict, finite budget of attention. Your brain physically cannot process every sensory input at once, so it forces a selection.
It filters things out.
Exactly. It relies on two massive opposing networks to manage what enters the stream of consciousness. You have the dorsal attention network, or the DAN, and the ventral attention network, the VAN.
Okay, DAN and VAN. Let's break those down.
So the DAN is top down. That's your voluntary, deliberate focus. When you're leaning in, listening to this deep dive, actively trying to visualize the anatomy, that's the DAN being driven by your cortical goals.
Got it. And the VAN?
The VAN is bottom up. It's reflexive. If a car suddenly backfires outside your window, the VAN hijacks your attention immediately to assess the threat, whether you wanted it to or not.
Wow, okay. But neither of these networks acts alone, right?
Yeah.
They rely on the subcortex to filter and redirect the signals. But attention is only half of the story.
Right, because what happens when you aren't paying attention to the outside world?
Exactly. When the external tasks stop, a fascinating system called the default mode network, or DMN, comes online.
A task negative network.
Yeah. When you are daydreaming, when you're replaying a conversation from yesterday, when you're thinking about your future, that is the DMN lighting up. And it operates like a seesaw with the attention networks. When external attention goes up, the DMN goes down.
And the mechanism that orchestrates this handoff is remarkable. Researchers believe a tiny, thin, irregular sheet of gray matter deep in the brain, called the claustrum, acts as the ultimate conductor.
The claustrum.
Yeah, it wraps around a region called the insula and connects to almost everywhere in the cortex. It sends sweeping electrical signals that synchronize brain waves, effectively deciding which network has the microphone.
Wait, did they find a way to test that?
Yes. There was even a documented clinical case where stimulating the area near the claustrum literally toggled a patient's conscious awareness off and on, essentially resetting their conscious state.
That is incredible. The way I picture it, the attention networks, the DAN and the VAN, they're like a theatrical spotlight cutting through a dark stage.
Oh, I like that.
They illuminate exactly what you need to see, whether you are the operator pointing the light yourself or the spotlight is snapping to a sudden loud noise in the wings. But the DMN is the house lights coming up when the performance is over.
Yeah, a much broader glow.
The tight spotlight turns off. The entire theater is illuminated softly, and you're free to just wander through the aisles of your own mind.
But what happens when the theater's lighting board short circuits? That is where we hit the clinical stakes. Understanding how these networks balance isn't just biological trivia.
No, it has real-world consequences.
Massive ones. The default mode network turns up in the pathology of almost every major mental health condition. In anxiety and depression, parts of the DMN become hypercoupled. That house lighting gets stuck on high.
Oh, wow.
The brain loses the ability to seamlessly switch back to the external attention networks, which neurologically explains that relentless looping rumination. The self-focused worry physically pushes out the external world.
And in schizophrenia, the DMN misfires differently, right?
Huh?
It blurs the boundaries, switching haphazardly between inward and outward modes.
Right, which contributes to the inability to separate an internal thought from an external hallucination.
And tragically, in Alzheimer's disease, the DMN becomes profoundly underactive. The physical connections just wither.
Which provides a neurological explanation for something families experience firsthand. Relatives often say that a loved one with Alzheimer's doesn't just lose their memories, they seem to lose their sense of self.
Because the network that builds that self is degrading.
Exactly. The default mode network is what pieces together our autobiographical memory to create the ongoing narrative of who we are. When that specific network deteriorates, the narrative fragments.
But the absolute highest stakes come into play with disorders of consciousness. Conditions like the vegetative state, or what's more accurately called unresponsive wakefulness syndrome.
Right.
The source material details an fMRI study that fundamentally changed how neurologists view these patients. A woman had been completely unresponsive for months after a car crash. Her body showed no signs of awareness.
But researchers put her in a functional MRI machine, right?
Yes, which tracks blood oxygenation in the brain as a proxy for neural activity. And they asked her to simply imagine playing tennis.
And to do that, the brain has to comprehend the language, sustain top-down attention, and activate the supplementary motor area. A reflex cannot mimic that sequence.
Exactly. And her brain's motor regions lit up identically to a healthy volunteer's.
Mm.
She was in there, imagining the swing of the racket, the movement across the court. Her mind was entirely intact, but her body was a locked door.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this perfectly mirrors locked-in syndrome, or LIS. The classic case is Jean-Dominique Bauby, who suffered a massive brainstem stroke.
The author, right?
Yes. He was left completely paralyzed, save for his left eyelid. And with that single blinking eye, he dictated an entire brilliant memoir, letter by letter.
That is just astounding.
It is the ultimate proof that a vibrant, fully conscious inner life can exist behind a motionless exterior.
So the profound lesson here for clinicians, and really for all of us, it's how we read silence.
Yeah.
You must separate arousal from awareness. Just because someone cannot speak or move, you have to rule out the mechanical confounders.
Right. Are they in pain but paralyzed?
Or is it aphasia, meaning their language centers are physically damaged and they simply cannot process your words or generate their own, even though their consciousness is perfectly clear? You must always give the possibility of inner experience the benefit of the doubt.
Because we started by looking for a single seat of consciousness, but the anatomy points to a layered, highly networked symphony.
Mm-hmm.
You have the cortex providing the high-definition details of human experience, the complex self-model, the shifting of the spotlight.
Right.
But you also have this ancient deep brain engine providing the raw primal feeling of being alive. And while the debate between the cortex and the subcortex isn't entirely settled, the technology to map it is evolving rapidly.
So what does this all mean? Well, the source material points toward a new technique called transcranial focused ultrasound, or TFUS.
Oh, this is fascinating tech.
Yeah. It's a non-invasive way to probe these deep brain structures without opening the skull. It uses targeted acoustic waves to mechanically shake the cell membranes of specific neurons deep in the subcortex.
So no surgery required.
Exactly. This shaking literally pops open their ion channels, triggering them to fire. It could finally prove whether tweaking the subcortex directly changes the subjective feelings a person reports experiencing.
And as you navigate your day, the practical takeaway is to carry this dimensional view of consciousness with you. Recognize that the people around you and the animals you encounter are all experiencing a deeply rich inner stream shaped by their own unique biology.
That's a great point.
And most importantly, extend grace to those who might be trapped in silence, whether that silence is caused by severe depression, cognitive decline, or a physical barrier. The mind is resilient, and the internal theater is often fully illuminated, even when the doors are locked from the outside.
I love that. And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We mentioned that new ultrasound tech, TFUS, which might soon map out the exact circuits of our perception. But the source material admits a humbling truth. Even if we perfectly map the brain, it won't solve the hard problem.
It won't explain the feeling.
Exactly. It won't explain why physical biology feels like anything at all. So imagine a future where a carefully aimed sound wave can perfectly toggle your awareness or your emotions on and off just by mechanically shaking your cells. If your profound, private stream of consciousness can be remote-controlled by acoustic waves, does that make your inner self just a complex biological machine, or is there still something deeply magical in the simple fact that you are there, in the dark, to experience the switch being flipped? Think about that the next time you catch yourself daydreaming.